Roz Wine. We are continuing an oral history interview for Pittsburgh Section National Council of Jewish Women on Mrs. Elaine Light. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, 1992. This will be tape 2, side 3. Mrs. Light, will you please give us your address and birth date?
I live in...
Okay.
My address is apartment 9C, Chatham Tower in downtown Pittsburgh.
Is that two?
Mrs. Light, on the last tape that we did of you, on the last question, the machine shut off before we got the answer, but I do remember the question you were telling us about. I believe it was your daughter Meredith, who was staying with a friend of yours, and the friend questioned her about how she felt about having a father that was a lot older than her friend's fathers. And then the machine, the technical difficulty came up, it didn't pick up Meredith's answer.
Well, I think she gave them a perfectly beautiful answer. She said, I never thought about it. I just knew he was my daddy. And she absolutely adored her father.
Isn't that beautiful? You must have been very proud when you heard that from your friend.
Yes, I was. My husband was a wonderful father to my children. And, well, I wouldn't recommend it for everyone, but since I was considered to be like 100 when I was born, it worked out perfectly for me.
There's someone for everyone, I guess.
That is right. I had an old German professor at the University of Pittsburgh who had a great influence on my life, Dr. Lottie Lostetter, and she had great sayings, and one of which was that there is a lid for every pot.
Oh, that's very cute. I think I've heard that before. It's an old goodie, right? Elaine, what was Pitt like during the war with so few men on campus? Do you recall?
Well, when I started to Pitt, of course, the war was not on, and but it came about very shortly because I started to Pitt in the fall of 1940. I got through my freshman year, and I started to... I think Pitt did not have a journalism department, but I did have a minor in journalism. You weren't, for women at least, there again, discrimination. For some reason or other, we were not permitted to work on the Pitt News until our sophomore year, although boys could begin in their freshman year. So I had really just gone to work on the Pitt News because of my interest in sports. I immediately went on the sports staff, and there again, that was before the war, so it didn't have anything to do with it. Pearl Harbor came about in December of that year, and I remember that I was writing for the paper at that time and that I wrote an editorial about the war. I have not read that editorial, obviously, in 50-some years. But somebody did tell me that it was read in classes, so I guess it was all right. I really want to go back someday and read that editorial. What happened was, of course, that the journalism department went to war, so those courses were finished. We did have men on campus. We had the servicemen on campus. Pitt was the center of the AMGOT program, which was where they were training military governors to take over these various countries after the war. Boys kept coming and going. We had a football team, even though it was made up sometimes of 4Fs and 18-year-olds. And the oddity of particularly the team of 1944 was that some of those boys would be playing for Pitt one semester and come back to play against them in the Great Lakes Naval Training Station the next. In many ways, it was a very, very interesting time to be there, and certainly I had unprecedented opportunity to cover sports because the men more or less had gone to war.
Now, what you just said, you became interested in writing about sports while you were in high school?
Yes, because I admired sports writers. I admired their freedom to be able to write. And I wanted to be a writer, but for some reason or other, I always wanted to be a newspaper writer. And I just found that through the columns of Havey Boyle and Chet Smith, that you had a great deal more leeway and a great more opportunity to write.
Who were these people? They wrote for news.
Havey Boyle was the sports editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Chet Smith was the sports writer of the Pittsburgh Press. One of my more interesting experiences was in my junior year, when the war was on, Chet Smith called me one day and asked me if I would be interested in working on the Pitt Sports Department, which really was the climax, I suppose, of all my hopes and dreams and aspirations. The only trouble was that I had another year of school to go. And I began to see how I was not prepared to give up school, and I went to see how many courses I would have to take, night courses, in order to get a degree. And when I found out how many one credit and two credit courses were involved, I lost a great deal of appetite for it. Meanwhile, it really never came to fruition because Mr. Smith thought that he was going off to war. He was expecting a commission, which he did not get. And so I think everything really worked out very well. I finished my course. I stayed around Pitt long enough to become sports editor and head of the Pitt pep rallies. And I had unusual experiences. You know, I had bench privileges. I could sit on the bench. The only thing I could never do, and frankly it never occurred to me to do it or even want to do it, was go into the dressing room, where a great deal of the controversy seems to go on today about women sports writers. Other than that, there was nothing that was barred to me, even though I set precedence in doing it. You often look back now and think, why couldn't a woman sit in the press box? I assume it started because the women who normally might have sat in press boxes would have been the girlfriends or the wives or what have you of the sports writers. And as far as a woman being a sports writer, that simply had never occurred to anybody. It hadn't happened. So I do think that that was probably the principle to begin with. But they had other bars, too. They did not admit blacks to the press box. And there was a writer called Vince Johnson of the Post-Gazette who is now long gone, but I do admire Vince because he took a stand against that. I recall writing editorials in Pitt because they did not admit blacks to the band. We wrote
articles. Talking about the marching band?
Yeah.
They
the Pitt band, they did not admit blacks. It was a different world. And when I talk about Amgott, and I did mention Lottie Lostetter, who was a dear friend, that woman had worked at Pitt. She had gotten her doctorate. She was the first woman to get it. She was a little German immigrant, really, who was the first woman to get her doctorate in course. She was a friend of the chancellor. She babysat, I believe, for Chancellor Bowman's children. Women were so discriminated against. She had started and she was an instructor. She had eventually become an assistant professor, which is about the lowest rung in the academic circles. She was making $125 a month. And when the Amgott, these are the military governor candidates, came in, they were making $200 a month. And she went to the chancellor and she asked if they would raise her salary. And she was told that they could not do that because she was only an assistant professor and they could not make her an associate professor because of her age. Now, she had been discriminated against because she was a woman all those years until she achieved that age. And in utter disgust, she retired and she vowed never, never to teach again. And she worked for many years at Shadyside Hospital, really working in the diet kitchen. I think she interpreted. She had at that point taught what was then required, medical German, to just about every doctor in the city of Pittsburgh. And yet, I mean, she was held at $125 a month because she was a woman, and she was denied promotion because she was a woman. Until she was too old to be promoted because she was a woman.
So there was discrimination.
Oh, very, very overtly.
Were there any women that were Jewish? And they may not have even known you were Jewish.
No, I think they knew. There was never any secret about it. I don't know. There were a lot of, you know, there were many, many Jewish women students.
Were there
women professors? No, I doubt it. I don't know what anybody's religion was.
And how about the Jewish men? Were there many on the writing staffs and so?
Yes, on
there
the
were.
Writing staff. Oh, yeah. In fact, Alex Zelensky, who was...
Alex Zelensky, who owns the
Yeah, he was the sports editor. He's the one who selected me as his successor. No, there
he
were many Jewish students on the papers. In fact, I think I should say, in all fairness, the University of Pittsburgh, not only was I sports editor, but I was asked by the chancellor himself to take the editorship rather than the sports editorship. And that, I always say, was the one mistake I made in my life. It probably wasn't a mistake in the sense of achieve whatever I wanted to achieve, but I could have accomplished a lot more as editor of the Pitt News, and I was asked to become editor, and I was asked by the chancellor himself. So
why did you turn it down?
Because to me it seemed that anybody could become, any woman could become editor, and any woman could not become sports editor. Today I would say this is very foolish, and I would not applaud my decision. But at that time, it seemed to be the right. I recall crying, literally crying tears on the streetcar going home because the chancellor wanted me to be editor of the Pitt News.
But you broke the barrier.
I broke the barrier. I guess I wanted to be different. And to me, I was doing what I wanted to do.
Good for you. Was your husband interested in spectator sports, as you obviously were?
Well, he was interested in spectator sports, but, I mean, he was a sportsman, which is entirely different. He was interested in the woods. He was interested in the outdoors. He was interested in hunting. He was interested in fishing. And above all, he was interested in dogs, none of which interested me except the results of the hunting and the fishing. I like fish, and I like game birds, certain game birds.
To eat?
Yes.
Not to hunt?
Not
fish.
To hunt, no. I don't not like the I am not a woodsman, and I am not an outdoorsman. And I never made any apologies. My husband was 54 when he was married, and I said that if he wanted a sporting woman, he had many years in which to find one.
Wonderful. I'm going to jump a bit now to because that brings us up to date on some of the questions that we need answered from our first tape of questioning you. Really interested in the Jewish aspect a little bit in Punxsutawney. Were there many Jewish families at that time when you, the years,
I think
the early years?
When I first went there, there were, and then gradually they intermarried and left until the point today, as I say, there's barely a handful. I don't think you could count the...
You have an approximation. How many did you think when you, in your early marriage, you were
raising
children?
In the early marriage, I mean, there were enough that there was a synagogue that had a rabbi every year. He didn't last very long. I mean, they never stayed very long, but I mean, there always was a rabbi. Uh-huh. And there was a Sunday school.
He's not a permanent rabbi.
Yeah, he was permanent, but he, you know, it was a beginning there job. And they just.
A rabbi who was there every day.
Yeah, uh-huh. There was somebody who was there every day. And there were two large main families, which would probably be the Pete family.
The what families?
Pete. P E T E.
Oh.
They're the Brodies.
Jewish name.
Pete and the Brodies.
Oh.
Well, I think that I did one of the stories in my column is about Old Abe Pete. If you are interested in the Pete family.
Yeah, I know.
And the other one was the Brody family. The
well, they were related. They were related. And let me read to you about Mr. Pete. Now, where?
The older Mrs. Pete was a Brody.
Yes, she was a Brody.
This is out of your People Who Love Groundhogs book. Excerpts of different columns that you've written while you were in Punxsutawney, and there was a booklet made.
Oh, here it is. End of an era.
End of an era.
The long, hot summer has seen the passing of many of Punxsutawney's most esteemed citizens. Some, like Abram Pete, had lived well beyond the biblical mark of 70. For the town and for their families, their loss meant the ending of an era as well. Abe Pete, who died last week at the age of 91, was the last of the old Jewish peddlers who, with packs on their backs, carried merchandise to the area miners and farmers. He arrived in Punxsutawney by train in 1908, a spindly youth in ill-fitting clothes with a tag pinned to his coat reading to Abe Brody, Oneida. Abe Brody was his wife's uncle. His cousin, the late Israel Brody, met him at the station. Pete spoke no English. His few possessions were in a straw valise. His daughter, Ruth Pete Lipner, State College PA, says her father often recalled that he looked so much a, quote, greenhorn, end quote, that his ashamed cousin hustled him through all the back alleys and streets to avoid meeting anyone. In Oneida, then a flourishing mine town, the Brodies had a department store. The young Pete, his name was then Petluck, but the Brodies shortened it to Pete, with the result that for years residents thought his name was Pete Brody. Was outfitted with a pack and sent to peddle his wares. Back in his native Lithuania, he had left an infant daughter and his young wife, Jenny Brody, Pete, whom he had met when he went to her home to teach Ipro to her brother. It was 5 long years before he had enough money to send for them. Ruth Lipner said her father told how often during those years he would remove the heavy pack from his back and sit down in a field and cry bitter tears of loneliness. Once he went to New York intending to return to Lithuania, but was dissuaded by a relative who told him, if you go, you will never come back. Later, during World War II in Europe, his 3 sisters, a brother, and their families were murdered in Hitler's gas chambers. In America, he prospered. He earned enough to become a partner in the Brody store, and it became Brody and Pete. A few years later, he bought out his uncle. His wife and daughter were now with him, and Ruth recalls how at age 11, she wrote business letters for her father. Although her father learned to speak and read English, he rarely wrote it. Ruth recalls that her father often spoke a mixture of English and Yiddish, a rich Jewish dialect somewhere related to German. Sometimes he lapped into Yiddish unconsciously, thus bewildering an audience not attuned to the joys of Yiddish. Once at the Elk Club, as someone asked him where my mother was, she said. He replied, "She's at home Beglin." To those who might wonder what exotic or unmentionable task she was doing, Beglin meant ironing. In 1913, the Pete store in Oneida carried $10,000 stock in shoes alone. There were miners' caps, corsets, yard goods, and hair ribbons. Oneida was a polyglot United Nations of Swedes, Poles, Italians, and Slavs. Somehow in that Tower of Babel, they all understood on one another and were friends. For years, my father loved to attend the Oneida reunions, his daughter said. He was always greeted with deep affection and open arms. He was an honest man. When times changed, A.P. changed with him. By now, his family included son Sam, Lester, and Bill, and another daughter, Florence. He bought the former Gil Bloom store on West Mahoning Street in Punxsutawney and moved here. His store became a ladies' specialty shop to be called the Smart Shop. He didn't know anything about women's fashions, Ruth said, but he prospered. I remember decorating the windows. For the first time, we displayed clothes and windows by removing the price tags and pinning back the sleeves. We coordinated colors for window displays. One of the sympathy cards prized by the family came from the Joseph Lucarts and was signed Roses from four generations of shoppers. He was a deeply religious man and was both the conscience and the guiding light of the local Jewish community. He was instrumental in the construction and the maintenance of the Church Street Synagogue. He was learned in Hebrew law and could recite the sacred scrolls of the Talmud and Torah. Like rabbis of old, he could spend endless hours discussing them and his assorted wisdoms. God was good to him in years and in health. Only in his last few months was there any deterioration of the life and vigor that sustained him for so long. He often said to his family, "God doesn't owe me anything." His charities were endless, both sectarian and non-sectarian. "My father's house was always filled with alms boxes for the poor," Ruth said, "and there was usually some bearded visitor seeking funds seated at our dinner table." He and his wife, Jenny, would have celebrated their 71st wedding anniversary August 20th. On their 50th wedding anniversary, they repeated their vows at a beautiful party at the Punxsutawney Country Club. For one who lived so long, his life knew sorrow and tragedy as well as many joys. But his devotion to his family was returned manyfold. His favorite saying was, "Honor not a man for his possessions alone. Honor him most for what use he makes of them." As the overflow crowded his funeral attested, he had made the most of his time and of his means.
Beautiful poem. Wow, what a tribute to that man.
And then there's, if you're still interested in the Jewish, there's one here on Joe Levy, who started supermarket in western Pennsylvania.
Started the concept of supermarkets.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Invented the cards. It's all out of Punxsutawney.
All these things came out of Punxsutawney. Tell me something about the Punxsutawney Country Club. Was it the non-sectarian?
It was when I joined it. I mean, I guess it was, because Sam's father, I believe, was one of the founders.
Did Sam have religious training?
Yes, I'm sure he did. And he...
Did he observe holiday? Did you?
Not much. I mean, he observed them.
For tradition.
He would go to the synagogue and stay 5 minutes and come back. But he went.
Okay. And did your daughters, did you send them to Sunday school?
They went to Sunday school as long as there was one.
Uh-huh. In Punxsutawney. I wanted to ask you, you were talking earlier about Pittsburgh newspapers. What were the names of the newspapers in those days? Was there a Post-Gazette
there? Oh, yes, there was a Post-Gazette, the Pittsburgh Press, and the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph, which was a Hearst paper. At one point, in the 60s, I believe, the Post-Gazette bought out the Sun-Telegraph. And the Sun-Telegraph had a Sunday paper, and it had always been the dream of the Post-Gazette to have a Sunday paper, which they wanted to model after the New York Herald Tribune. When they combined, they took over the Sun-Telegraph, and they put out a Sunday paper, and that just about sunk them. That is why they wound up losing their building and going in with the Pittsburgh Press, which is what causes the mess today, which is, in view of a strike, we don't have any newspapers in Pittsburgh.
Was the Post-Gazette at that time owned by Block?
Yes, it still was a Block
same
paper.
Family.
Same thing. Mm-hmm. But what scuttled them was the Sunday paper, which was a wonderful Sunday paper, but the press has an iron grip on
that. Oh, do you think that was why? I was going to say, why do you think that paper did not go? The Sunday, it'd be nice to have a second Sunday paper. Nice to have any
It was
paper
a great
now.
Paper. It was, of course, why don't they have the New York Herald Tribune in New York either? They have fewer papers in New York City than they do here. At least we have a morning and an evening paper. There is no evening paper there. I just came from New York, so I know.
No evening paper.
were, at the time that you worked for Associated Press, they had a Pittsburgh office, I presume. Is that
the... Yeah, there were two offices, and of course the day office was in the Sun-Telegraph building, which is approximately where we're standing now. I'm very close. I've never left. I always think one of the funny things is I never saw Caldwell Street, but I always heard about it because this was the Lower Hill District where my grandmother, and apparently they settled and got started, but I would always hear about it. I don't think I was ever there. I never saw it. I didn't know where it was until Mayor Sophie Maslow, her administration, began putting street signs up. And now that I find, when I pull out of my garage, I'm really on Caldwell Street, which shows that you never fall, what is it, the apple never falls far from the tree.
So the Associated Press was located in the Sun-Telegraph
We had two
building.
Offices. The night office was in the Post-Gazette building. Now, the Post-Gazette building is now the public safety building.
Oh.
Because the Post-Gazette lost their building, and of course the Sun-Telegraph building was a horrible old building, I might add. It was no loss to the city when it went down.
Their day office is...
Well, there were two offices then. Now the AP has their own office, and their office is in the Westinghouse building.
Oh.
But that all occurred after I left. But when I worked for the AP, the day office opened at 7 o'clock in the morning, and you got copies of all of the Sun-Telegraph stories.
Is that when you had to report for work that early in the morning?
No, it depended on which shift. I generally liked the night shift. I preferred working from 6:30 to 3 a.m., believe it or not. It gave me all day. But there were really two shifts. Actually, there was a 4 to a, I think there was a 3 to 11, and an 11 to 7. And it's 6:30 to 3. I liked 6:30 to 3. It gave me a lot of time. Or else I really was not very fond of 7 a.m. That's not my time of day. I'm not a day person. 7 to 3. But generally, I did not work those hours. And I like working weekends. I liked having 2 days off in the middle of the week because I found you could travel and do a lot more. Stories were open and things were open.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the name of the editor that sent you off to Punxsutawney where you met Sam?
Yeah, it was a man named Wick Temple, and he had just become...
Wick.
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 Temple. T-E-M-P-L-E. He was a very intense, driven man from Philadelphia who had replaced a very gentle, wonderful man that I loved very much, Joe Snyder, who had been promoted to head of the bureau in Philadelphia. And Wick Temple, I got along with him, but I mean, he was a very intense, driving man, and he was so anxious to have this story before anybody else that he sent me to Punxsutawney and insisted that I stay there, let's say, until the story was written.
What did he say when you told him you were going to marry and settle in Punxsutawney? He had to have said something to you.
Yeah, he said, or at least Joe Snyder said, would you consider taking a leave of absence instead of resigning? I think that was very nice.
Oh, they really did like you. What was, you worked actually for the Associated Press after World War II, more or less, was over.
Yeah, the war ended in 1945,
and
I didn't leave until 1950. They had made me permanent after the first year, because you're all hired. And for instance, I worked with a woman named... Joanne Skidmore, who recently died, she replaced her husband, who had gone into service. She had to sign a paper saying that she would give up her job when he returned. And very reluctantly, she did give it up when he came back. And he was sent to the Harrisburg Bureau, and eventually they both left the AP because in those days, husbands and wives could not work together. They didn't permit them to work together. Everything has changed so much. I had a friend whose mother is still living at the age of 90-something, who worked at Mellon Bank, where married women were not permitted to work. And so she had to hide her husband all the time and pretend she wasn't married.
I would like to ask something that we should have asked you at the beginning of our interviews all together. What was your mother's name and her maiden name?
Her name was Solwitz, S-O-L-W-I-T-Z. And she was
What's
one...
What's her first name?
Ida.
Ida. And your dad's name?
Alexander. Yeah. He was from Cleveland.
He was a Cleveland resident.
Uh-huh.
Met your mother, who's a Pittsburgher.
I think we were discussing that. And as you know, I went to New York because my cousin was very dear, the one whose book is reviewed in the New York Times on Sunday, who came out at the right time with the right book. And there was a tremendous amount of publicity on it because of the Supreme Court decision on abortion coming out the day that the book was officially launched by Simon & Schuster. and Ellen was very nice. She said that I was the writer in the family who inspired her. I can't quite believe that because we are entirely different writers, certainly. I don't think I could ever attempt a book like that. I would never attempt a book, as a matter of fact. I don't have that much to say. Not in a book, anyway.
I think you do, but...
But we were talking with her mother and father. Now, that's about the last of the family. Her father was my father's nephew. Her grandmother was my father's sister. And we were getting a little bit of family history because I find that you're always interested in these things when it's too late to achieve them. The people that you should be asking the questions are no longer there. If they are there, they've forgotten it or they don't want to talk about it. I tried to ask my father questions, and he simply was no longer interested, or if he remembered, he didn't want to remember. And I thought all those years probably when he was longing to tell somebody the stories of his youth, no one wanted to listen. And when we wanted to listen, he didn't want to, or he either didn't want to or couldn't talk.
Couldn't remember.
So I was asking Howard something because there are so many breaks that I don't know. I believe that my father came to this country, well, he had to come around 1915 or 1916. He served, his proudest moments were the years that he served in the First World War. He used to wear his Legion uniform so much that our neighbors really thought that he was a policeman. The Legion was the dearest thing in his life, and when he died at the age of 93, 94, I had him buried in his Legion uniform.
Mm-hmm. That's the American Legion.
I had had it cleaned and put away when he went into the nursing home because I knew how often and how proudly he had worn it. As long as he was able, he was a sergeant of arms. I always see he lived in the Riverview, and I always knew his window because he always had a little American flag stuck in a vase, possibly with water in the vase, I don't know. But I could always see that little American flag in the window.
And he lived at Riverview Towers.
He and my mother were the first tenants who moved in.
Mm-hmm. My mother was too.
And my mother died in 1969. She was 81. And he lived another 10 years.
She died in 1969.
And he died in 1979.
But they moved there as a couple.
As a couple.
And he died in 1979,
Halloween Day.
Do you recall the names of any of the women reporters on the Pittsburgh newspapers?
Well, it's very easy because there weren't very many. There was, in fact, one way that I was able to help my cousin with her book, my second cousin really, was the fact that I knew Anna Jane Phillips Schumann. Anna Jane Phillips came from a very fine old Pittsburgh family. John M. Phillips, her father, was a leading conservation expert or believed in it. And Anna Jane was one of the one, she was hired by the Post-Gazette. She was a Post-Gazette reporter, and her story was, I guess, really very romantic too, because she wound up married to Joe Schumann, who was Jewish and who was, I guess, son of immigrants too. And they were, I think, a very happy couple, raised two children. But Anna Jane was a very fine person, and her mother was very active in the beginning of Planned Parenthood, Mrs. John Phillips. So Anna Jane went to India with Margaret Sanger in 1936, according to my cousin's book. And when Ellen came here for my 25th wedding anniversary in 1975, I was able to set up an interview, and she spent a long afternoon with Anna Jane, which is duly noted in her books.
Mm-hmm.
Called Woman, I guess you get a plug in, Woman of Valor.
So she was
the wife of Margaret Sanger by Ellen Chesler.
Is that what she wrote?
This is the book, yes. It just came out.
Okay.
The title of the book is Woman
of Valor. It has a dual, you know, Woman of Valor, yeah. Margaret Sanger by Ellen Chesler, C-A-G-S-L-E-R.
And that's your cousin?
Yeah.
Oh. Woman of Valor. Do you recall the names of some of the very famous people that you got to interview?
Oh, I had a wonderful time. I interviewed, I went down to the railroad station and saw President Truman. I went to one of Harry Truman's, I went to New York once, I mean to Washington, D.C. once, and I walked into the AP office and the man in charge said to me, how would you like to go to the President's press conference? It was just a few months after President Roosevelt had died. And so I Sure, I'd love to go to the president's press conference. It was very easy in those days. They had your name at the door. You went in. You walked toward the... There was a little anteroom before the Oval Office. I can still see it. There was a long table there. It was winter. You threw your coat... It was March. You threw your coat on the table. And you walked into the Oval Office, and I don't think there were more than a half dozen reporters. I was standing there with a man named Martin Arrowsmith, or Marvin Arrowsmith, who was the AP reporter, and they asked the president, trenchant questions like, what do you think about the number of deaths on the highway? And he said, I thought they were deplorable. And these were the kind of questions. The thing that impressed me most about Harry Truman, and I think I saw this same quote, there's a new biography by David McCullough of Pittsburgh that just came out on Harry Truman called Truman. And I think also he mentions the same thing, that what impressed me most, because these were the days before color television and before color anything. And Harry Truman always kind of, he always had what appeared to be a gray fedora, and he looked like a black and gray man. And here was this man with this incredible ruddy color. I have always been tremendously impressed with Harry Truman's color. Then, too, I covered Margaret Truman's singing concert debut, which was at the old Syria Mosque. That was most interesting because the way I did it was, of course, get quotes from all the music critics who accompanied her. And I sat in a box in front of her parents' box. Harry did not come for that, but her mother came. It was most interesting. I also once went up to the airport with Margaret Truman when she was here.